this was a landing accident. There were five people on board. Four basically suffered minor injuries, and one suffered fatal injuries.
A float plane crash kills former lawmaker Cheryl Hines. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, trying to understand high gas prices in Alaska.
At the end of the day, it's the competitive pressures in this market that ultimately set the price for our energy products.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
A float plane accident in Homer last night claimed the life of former Alaska State Legislator Cheryl Hines, who represented Anchorage for one term in 2003 and 2004. As KBBI's Aaron Selvig reports, federal investigators are unsure what exactly caused the Cessna 206 carrying Hines and four others to flip over while attempting to land on Homer's Beluga Lake.
Clint Johnson is an Anchorage-based investigator for the National Transportation Safety Board. He says the accident occurred Tuesday night, sometime between 10:30 and 10:45 p.m. on Beluga Lake, a popular floatplane base located between downtown Homer and the Homer Spit.
My understanding is the airplane departed from Anchorage, supposedly made a stop in Kenai, and then continued on to Homer. This was a landing accident. There were five people on board. Four basically suffered minor injuries, and obviously one suffered fatal injuries.
The airplane, a Cessna 206, was carrying four passengers plus the pilot, 71-year-old Evan Griffith of Anchorage. All of the crash victims work for the Matanuska Electric Association in Palmer, where Griffith is general manager and Hines was director of human resources and public affairs. Johnson says five passengers are typically not too much weight for a six-seater 206 to handle. He says a pair of NTSB investigators, accompanied by a dive team, arrived at the crash scene Wednesday afternoon, hoping to pull the aircraft out of the water Wednesday evening. Johnson expects a preliminary investigation on the crash to be finished by next week and a more comprehensive report to be issued within 6 months. According to the National Weather Service, the official forecast for Homer at the time of the accident called for southeast winds between 15 and 20 miles per hour. But Mary Ellen Ulrich, who lives on the north shore of Beluga Lake and witnessed the aftermath of the crash, says that wind gusts at the time were quite a bit stronger than that.
I got home from work last night, and I noticed on my deck all my flowers were blowing like crazy. The wind picked up, very hard, high wind. So I said to my husband, well, I should go out and move the plants off the tables and put them down. So I went out there, and then I see the, you know, we live on the lake, so we hear the planes all the time. I look, I see one coming in. I turn around to move a plant, and then I heard like a, you know, it sounded like they crashed into the water.
Ulrich's husband, Johnny, called 911, and soon emergency responders from the Alaska State Troopers, Homer Police Department, and Homer Volunteer Fire Department were on the scene, as well as a Good Samaritan floatplane that arrived minutes later. South Peninsula Hospital spokesperson Dorotha Ferraro says all the crash victims arrived at the hospital late Tuesday night. Four of them were treated and released, but Hines died early Wednesday morning as she was being prepared for transfer to an Anchorage hospital. According to her legislative bio, Cheryl Hines was born October 30, 1946, in Wewoka, Oklahoma. She held a teaching certificate from East Central University in Ada, Oklahoma, and a bachelor's degree from Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage. Hines lived all over Alaska, including Tok, Valdez, and Talkeetna, before settling in Anchorage in 1989, where she established herself as an artist and at one point owned an antique store on 4th Avenue downtown. In 2002, Hines was elected to the Alaska State Legislature, serving one term representing Anchorage's District 24. Homer Representative Paul Seaton worked with Hines during her time in the legislature, serving alongside her on a handful of committees. Seton remembers Hines as a gregarious person with an outsized sense of humor.
In one committee, we were talking about sablefish, blackcod, and this conversation had gone on for a while, and then she asked the question, well, what was it about these disabled fish that made them disabled? And so she had just misheard, but she took that all in stride, and she had a little wooden carving outside of her door, and she put a sign on that she kept on forever. I think it said, Home of the Disabled Fish. It was a real shame, you know, her loss.
Governor Sean Parnell has ordered state flags to fly at half staff on Friday, July 13th, in honor of Hines. In a news release Wednesday, Parnell called Hines, quote, a dedicated legislator who cared deeply for Alaska. Cheryl Hines is survived by her husband, Harold Hines, a former president of ARCO Alaska, commissioner of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, and CEO of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Legislators today began looking for ways to help lower energy costs for Alaskans, but they aren't finding many options yet. The Senate Energy Working Group Chairman Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, said the first of several anticipated hearings will address questions that frequently come up. He said gas prices in Anchorage are 40 to 50 cents above prices in the lower 48, and that is curious in a place where nearly 600,000 barrels of crude oil are produced daily, where gasoline taxes are the lowest in the nation, and where there is little transportation cost for locally produced fuel.
In South Carolina, for example, the average cost of gasoline today is $3. In Alaska, it is $3.92, with prices in some communities as high as $10 a gallon. Yet not a drop of oil is produced in South Carolina, and their gasoline taxes are roughly double what our taxes are, 16.8 cents in South Carolina versus 8 cents here. The hope is that this discussion this morning will shed some light on this.
Lawmakers heard from Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen, who said the biggest price factor in Alaska is the small market size. He said the small number of customers and the small number of suppliers means there is little competition, and that leaves the industry free to sell fuel at whatever price customers will pay.
From a legal perspective, there's nothing illegal about that. It's businesses trying to make money. And trying to draw a connection between the cost of a barrel of oil or what they're selling fuel for in South Carolina or Texas or Washington or California and what fuel is selling for here is it's interesting to look at, it's informative, and hopefully it'll help us get to some solutions. But at the end of the day, it's the competitive pressures in this market that ultimately set the price for our energy products.
Economist Barry Pulliam with the California firm Econ One recognized other factors that contribute to high prices, such as transportation costs and the lack of storage facilities in many communities. But he said the legislature should come up with ways that encourage competition on the statewide level. The working group plans future hearings on other energy-related issues and is authorized to contract for a study on the effect of energy prices in the state. The U.S. House of Representatives just voted to repeal President Barack Obama's health care overhaul. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, Representative Don Young joined his entire party in the vote.
This was the 31st vote in the House to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and it's one Republican leaders did not expect to take. After the U.S. Supreme Court mostly upheld the law, leaders scrambled to schedule this latest repeal bill. Chief Justice John Roberts' ruling labeled the so-called individual mandate that requires people to buy insurance or pay a fee as a tax, and that tax has become a major talking point both at the Capitol and on the campaign trail. Representative Young, who joined all of his Republican colleagues and a handful of Democrats in voting against the measure, called it just that.
Healthcare is a tax, and we had a president who ran out to be no new taxes, and he said that tax is going to hit everybody. And to a point where it'll cost us billions of dollars and they get worse health care.
Republicans contend there are dozens of new taxes in the bill, though the individual mandate remains the most controversial. Democrats counter the law would save billions of dollars in the long run. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A federal funding program key to Southeast school districts will remain in place for another year. An extension of the Secure Rural Schools program is part of a recently passed transportation bill. The program has been a mainstay for districts in or near national forests in and outside of Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the extension is only good for 1 year. She had hoped for more.
The bad news is that there's no glide path. What we were working on was a proposal that would allow for a 4 to 5 year kind of phase down, just kind of working it down to a point that was manageable, because right now there is no certainty after this year.
Alaska got more than $15 million for schools, roads, and some other projects from the program earlier this year. Murkowski says the next allocation will be 5% less. She says chances for a longer extension could improve next year. That's because the Energy and Natural Resources Committee comes up with the Senate's funding plan for the program. Murkowski will be the panel's ranking Republican member, and Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, who also supports the program, will be the ranking Democratic member.
So either he or I will be the chairman of the Energy Committee next year, depending on what happens with the majorities. So we've talked about this, about how we can work for a little more certainty to this program. I can't give you any real guidelines right now in terms of how we may take it, but I think we've got a better shot next year for a little longer approach to the program.
Without the extension, the program will revert to a formula that provides far less funding. The same bill also authorized another year of the Payment in Lieu of Taxes program that also provides federal funding to rural communities. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bering Strait adventurers create headaches for the town of Wales.
Before we know it, they're over and across there. And all of a sudden, it blows up in our faces.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. And organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska State Troopers and dozens of Delta Junction area volunteers are searching for a 20-year-old man who hasn't been seen since Sunday evening. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The number of volunteers has grown by the day since Martin Hosier was first reported missing Monday evening, about 24 hours after he was last seen in Delta. Today, dozens of volunteers again searched the area around the bluff just off the Richardson Highway at the Tanana River crossing, about 8 miles northwest of Delta. Searchers fanned out upon the bluff and along the banks of the Tanana while aircraft patrolled overhead, and several riverboats plied the Tanana looking for any signs of Hosier. Angela Macias is one of the volunteers who spent much of Tuesday cruising the Tanana. Macias says the river is running high, filled bank to bank due to recent rainfall throughout the area, and the river is full of logs and other debris.
There's so many trees and log jams and everything else in it, you know. So we were just trying to look through there and see if we could find anything.
Hosier's father, George, said in a Facebook posting on Tuesday that he's begun dragging the river. The bluff rises about 500 feet from the riverbanks and is a popular spot for hiking. Hosier is described as 5 feet 9 inches tall, 180 pounds, black hair and brown eyes. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Necropsy results show the baby beluga whale rescued in Naknek last month had multiple infections, including in his heart and lungs. Alaska Sea Life Center veterinarian Dr. Carrie Gertz says early tests also confirmed suspicions that the whale's immune system wasn't fully developed. The whale, estimated to be 2 days old when it was separated from its mother, was rescued in Alaska's Bristol Bay on June 18th. He was taken to the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, where it received around-the-clock care. The whale's condition deteriorated over the weekend, and it died early Monday. The The ballots closed just a few minutes ago in the final formality before next month's primary elections. Candidates who had filed to run in the party races had until 5 o'clock today to remove their names from consideration. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports that since the election season began, 11 people have backed out of running and 2 have been refused a spot on the ballot.
The ballots the voters will see next month cover 59 of the legislature's 60 seats up for election due to this year's redistricting plan. And there are 40% more candidates running for office than 2 years ago. But only 8 candidates can start picking out next year's office furniture, with no competition in either the primary or general elections. Elections Director Gail Fanumiai says the deadline is the final step toward preparing the ballot for voters.
Today's the final day for any candidate to withdraw from the primary election ballot and at close of business today, and we will be sending our ballot artwork to the printer in the morning to start getting ballots printed for the primary.
One thing Republicans will notice is the unusually large number of candidates in their party races. That'll give them lots of choices to make. Where 2 years ago, only 1 Senate race and 3 House races were contested in the GOP primary, members adhered to an unwritten rule: never speak ill of a fellow Republican. This year, as the party's leadership and profile prepare to change, that principle is being set aside, as Republican candidates in 7 Senate seats and 14 House seats face intra-party opposition. And a dozen of those are incumbents running for re-election. Candidates are not only seeing more contested races, many of those districts have several contenders, with 32 candidates for those House seats. Democrats are taking advantage of the changes being made within the Republican Party, as only 5 of their primary races in the House and 1 in the Senate are contested. Of those, only 3 incumbents face Democratic challengers. Fanumiai says the next calendar item for voters to know about comes at the end of the month.
The 29th of July is our registration deadline. So anybody needs to make, you know, changes to their registration, their party affiliation changes, register to vote for the first time in order to be able to vote in the primary. It has to be done by July 29th. They can go to any division of elections office. We have forms available on our website. Our offices will be open the weekend of the deadline for the public to come in.
The election is on schedule for August 28th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
6 American jet skiers are back on American soil after spending 5 days in detention in Lavrentia, Russia. The group crossed the Bering Strait without proper documentation while filming for the reality show Dangerous Waters. KNOM's Lorelai Kanin has more.
After a 6-hour trip across the Bering Strait, the 6 American jet skiers that were detained in Russia for 5 days were this afternoon in Teller and planned to make their way to Nome. The 6 Americans were filming for a reality show called Dangerous Waters and jet skied from Seattle to Wales and made their way across the Bering Strait to Lavrentia, Russia. And when they got there, they were met by a tank. The crew did not have valid travel documents to spend time in Russia. The crew had visas, but visas only allow travelers to arrive in a city commercially by airplane or cruise ship. They lacked permission to arrive and spend time in Chukotka and were held in a gymnasium for 4 nights until yesterday. A U.S. Customs official says it typically takes a year of planning and communication in order to properly travel to the western edge of the Bering Strait. And in their return to the U.S., the Port of Nome is classified as a port of entry. Wales is not. A customs official is needed for them to be cleared. Wales Mayor Frank Crissy says the jet skiers made it to Wales late last night, and their lack of planning had Mayor Crissy acting as somewhat of a border guard.
The people themselves, although they are Americans, must go through the proper channels to enter the country again. Right now, they would probably be classified as illegal aliens.
Mayor Crissy says this isn't the first time a group of adventurers did not have the proper authorization to head to Russia and back to the U.S. Wales is 110 miles closer to the west side of the Bering Strait than Nome, and Crissy says his city administration finds them acting in roles outside their jurisdiction.
In the future, they're going to have to do something about the customs. It's going to have to either be a field office out here or something is going to have to be done, because some people are not departing from Nome to go to Russia. They're coming here. We do not know who they are or what their purpose is. And before we know it, they're over and across there. And all of a sudden, it blows up in our faces.
The Dangerous Waters crew had planned on jet skiing and filming all the way to Vietnam. Being told to leave Russia, the crew now plans to travel the Northwest Passage, perhaps to Greenland and Iceland. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. If you've been trying to figure out how to finance your education and have strong academic and leadership skills, you may be eligible for a scholarship from the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks. Every year, the Elks National Foundation awards millions of dollars in scholarships. Applications are available at your guidance counselor's office or local Elks Lodge. Information at elks.org. Elks care, Elks share. This message is sponsored by the Alaska State Elks Association.
An animator from Fairbanks just raised more than $40,000 on Kickstarter to build an interactive story about a whale on driftwood stilts. Kickstarter is a website that provides a platform for grassroots do-it-yourself fundraising for projects like movies, music, and journalism. Now based in San Francisco, Gabriel Smetzer is able to devote himself fully to the project with the money he raised. APRN's Wendy Jonathan has more.
The story of Floon follows a bearded whale using driftwood stilts to walk across a desert after his ocean is drained. He's joined by his friends, a frog with a unicycle helicopter, a rabbit with homemade wings, and a seahorse in a jar, pushing like a hamster would push a ball, in search of a new home and answers to questions of how their home was destroyed. Smetzer, the animator behind the project, says once he established the character of the whale, he knew the story would be special.
One of the main concepts is, what if you took an animal out of its environment, and then what kind of thing would that animal invent if it had the human gift of invention? I also like to take another step further and see how they might adapt to their new environment or their new mode of transportation.
Since this story is told via electronic mediums like tablets and computers, Smetzer has taken the opportunity to incorporate music and ambient sounds, something he says will add depth and life to the story.
And I really wanted to create this immersive experience where there's music and ambient sounds. Like you feel part of the story when you hear the wind and the trees rustling in the wind. And I really wanted it to be an experience.
The way Smetzer tells the story and the way the audience digests it is pretty unique. It'll be an interactive story, a sort of choose-your-own-adventure meets The Sims. He explains the concept in a video he posted on Kickstarter to encourage donations.
To move the story forward, you don't turn pages, but keep your main character well-fed and flying through richly illustrated side-scrolling environments.
Where did Smetzer get his inspiration? He grew up in what he calls humble beginnings in a log cabin outside of Fairbanks. Like many other children growing up in Alaska, Smetzer loved being outside. He cross-country skied, he hiked, he played in the woods. But during the winter, he nurtured his creativity and began indulging in the fundamentals of animation.
But then you also have long winters, so you spend a lot of time indoors, and so you have to focus on something. You have to have to keep yourself sane, and I would draw a lot and play music and fiddle around on the computer.
Smetzer has been working on the story of Floon between freelance animation projects for the last year. But in order to fully commit to the project, he started a Kickstarter campaign to raise money. Over 1,200 people donated more than $44,000 in just 31 days, ending on the summer solstice. He says this money will allow him to hire a sound engineer, sound editor, and some string players like a cellist and a violinist. Contributors are also adding to the creativity in fun ways.
If you contributed $500, I'd make you a character that we could add into the story. There's definitely stipulations that I wouldn't want any kind of zombie Mickey Mouse. That'd be weird.
Floon may sound like a children's storybook, but Smetzer says he hopes it'll appeal to a wider audience.
That's sort of a balance I'm playing with having cute characters with big eyes, but also this whale is carrying this heavy burden, and a beard, and it, you know, it gives the story depth. So I think adults will enjoy it as much as children.
Smetzer says that the story can be finished by next year, but he hasn't established a set deadline yet. When it does come out, the audience will be able to download it on Kindles, iPads, Android devices, PCs, and Macs. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonasson.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks will become the nation's first to have an on-campus winter terrain park. It's midsummer, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, plans are in the works for the ski and snowboard facility.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Vice Chancellor Mike Sfraga says the plan is to install rails and jumps for snowboarders and skiers on a slope on the campus's west ridge as early as this fall.
Our target has been that when the snow flies, we've got at least something up there on that hill. It's a stretch goal, no doubt, but we're hoping that we at least get some components of a terrain park in place. I promised students last year and went way out on a limb on that one.
Sfraga says the project will be done in phases as funding becomes available. There won't be a half pipe, and skiers and boarders will initially have to walk back up the hill. But Sfraga says the longer-term plan includes a lift and other amenities.
We'd love to have a magic carpet so that when you're done with your skiing, you get on the magic carpet and you stand on it and it takes you back up to the top. We'd love to have lighting done the right way to light it up most of the winter. That, I think, is in sort of phase two and three.
Sfraga says a rope tow may be an interim step to the more expensive lift. The U.S. Terrain Park Council visited UAF last winter and has engineered the rails and jumps according to safe industry standards. Sfraga admits the project is a little unusual for a university, but says it's a good fit for UAF.
UAF has a long history of doing this. I look back at some archives. We have giant toboggan runs that were built out of wood in the 20s. We're not doing anything different here. It's almost back to the future, really playing to what it is and who we are, which is a far more adventurous campus and composition of faculty, staff, and students than most institutions.
Sfraga says the Terrain Park project is part of a broader outgrowth of outdoor facilities around UAF Student Recreation Center that includes a climbing tower as well as new ice rink and upgraded cross-country ski trail scheduled to open this fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.